Hello, and welcome to the Lies.com podcast for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2006. I have a few weeks of writing the wrong year on checks before I'm used to it being 2006, I'm sure. I actually recorded this podcast, I recorded a podcast last Friday on my way into work, but the audio quality was not what I wanted. And I generally was just rambling more than I would have liked to be, so I'm trying it again, hopefully with less rambling and better audio. One thing that I spent pretty much the entire podcast, the aborted podcast on Friday, talking about was this whole issue with Bush's warrantless searches, that is his authorizing in the wake of the September 11th attacks and then on into the years since then, continuing to reauthorize the tapping of U.S. Telephone and I assume other sorts of communications by the National Security Agency in apparent violation of the 1970s era federal law that requires the president to go to the so-called FISA courts, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act courts. And, you know, there's been a lot said about it in the last few weeks since the New York Times, after sitting on the story for a year, went ahead and went public with it. The president's supporters, after an initial bit of sort of confusion and uncertainty, have come out swinging. You know, it takes a few days for the White House political operation to figure out what their spin is going to be and to get that distributed through the various parts of the right-wing echo chamber. I'm not sure that that's hugely different from the situation when the left-wing echo chamber ends up being caught flat-footed by some high-profile problem like, I don't know, Clinton's semen on Monica's dress. I do certainly recall a period of confusion and surprise from people whose sympathies I have, with whose political views I'm more sympathetic during the first few weeks after that story came out. And in thinking about it, you know, in trying to put my Lies.com manifesto into actual practice, which is always harder, of course, it's always harder to actually live up to some principle than it is to just elucidate it as an abstract concept. But in trying to live up to that manifesto and be objective about this, be rational about this, to try to see it not as a fan in a football contest, but you know, rooting for one side or the other, but more as someone concerned about the truth, independent of his particular set of a priori biases. I've had this, I guess I'd call it a minor moment of clarity with respect to the Bush revelations about the warrantless wiretapping. It's not a big moment of Satori, not a big sudden dramatic realization, but coming on top of some things I was thinking already, it reinforced some of that, and just on an emotional level kind of clicked for me. And this is basically the idea that I actually see Bush as having a fairly good case in defending his warrantless searches, but with a very important asterisk attached to it. And the case I see him making is this, and here of course I'm discounting without any serious consideration some of the stuff he said that is, I think, just obviously ludicrous spin. Saying that, well, he briefed members of Congress, yes, but you know, the law doesn't say anything about briefing a few members of Congress who are then sworn to secrecy and can't reveal anything about your program, that does not qualify under the Constitution's requirements for checks and balances on the executive. So we'll forget about that. And I think it's clearly a stretch that the Congress, by voting him the War Powers Resolution in the, or I'm not War Powers, whatever the name of the use of force, the resolution to pursue, including with the use of force, the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, you know, Bush's argument, legal argument, that implicit in that vote was that, of course, he could set aside Fourth Amendment protections for U.S. citizens. It was just understood. And, of course, you know, the obvious rejoinder to that, at least one of the, I'm not sure it's an obvious legal rejoinder, but the obvious sort of political talking points rejoinder to that as well. If he was so convinced it was authorized under that act, why this need for secrecy about it? You know, why is it a big, why couldn't he have just gone to the courts or gone to the Congress quietly and said, well, you know, as a result of granting me these powers, I'm going to need to do this? And the answer, of course, is that they would have, well, not of course, but I'll get to that in a minute. But my assumption in that case, and I think the assumption of anybody being fairly rational about this, is that the reason why this was kept secret, and, you know, partly this may have been, it may have been kept secret in part because we didn't want the bad guys to know what we were doing, although I think that's a pretty slim read to cling to. The more obvious answer is that, well, he didn't tell anyone what he was doing because he didn't want to be stopped, because he wanted to do it, and he was aware that it was, to put it, to bend way over backwards in favor of Bush's position, there were some legal doubts about his position in pursuing this eavesdropping on people within the United States. So, setting aside those kinds of specious arguments, the case he can make that I think is actually the strongest, and, you know, clearly they pull these arguments and they go with the ones that resonate, and this is the one he's been hitting the hardest on, is that, well, as Commander-in-Chief, he has a constitutional requirement, a constitutional responsibility to defend the people of the United States against foreign attacks, against attacks from outside dangers. And with September 11th having changed everything, it was necessary for him to take these actions. Okay, so, you know, I think that actually is, on some level, a valid argument. September 11th attacks were horrific, and not just in a, you know, people dying kind of way, although certainly I'm not trying to minimize people's deaths. Now, there was a sort of James Bond villain, massive evil element to it. And in the face of that, you know, I could understand, just like in the face of the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, that you know, the country came together and their response was, hey, you know, we are under attack, like antibodies in a host that suddenly detects some dangerous new assault. You know, collectively, the people of the United States had a visceral reaction of, hey, we need to defend ourselves. We need to set aside our differences. And of course, and that's where you saw, you know, Bush's approval ratings rise into the, you know, 90% plus range. You know, he may not have been the best president, but he was our president at the time, and he was the, you know, you go to war with the army you have. And while a lot of people, myself included, had and continue to have what, again, I'll charitably describe as grave doubts about Bush's competence as a leader, in the wake of the September 11th attacks, you know, I and a lot of other people were willing to set that aside and say, okay, you know, let's forget about our differences for a minute. What are you going to do to solve this problem? What are you going to do now? And at the time, we now realize, in hindsight, one of the things Bush did is he went to the National Security Agency and he said, you know, that rule about not spying domestically, well, for the purposes of the pursuit of the perpetrators of these terrorist attacks and for the purposes of the attempt to identify and thwart upcoming attacks, that rule is no longer operative. You know, you are hereby authorized under my authority as president to go ahead and do this. Now, you know, we'll obviously learn a lot more about this story as time goes on. We still have relatively few details about what actually happened. You know, I listened to Condoleezza Rice on Meet the Press from a few weeks ago. One of the nice things about my commute, which I continue to strain to find any nice things I can about this drive, one of the nice things about it is that it does allow me to listen to the audio of those, a lot of programs that I would, you know, in general like to watch on TV, but really don't feel like I have the time. Well, now I can download their audio that they make available and listen to it in the car. So I listened to the audio of Condoleezza Rice on Meet the Press, and you know, she was advancing the administration's arguments and defending this act and these actions. And you know, as I say, a lot of them I think were specious. Some of them I think maybe have some degree of merit, but we really don't know yet. We really don't have details. And despite, you know, there's talk now that the White House is working feverishly to try and make sure that the upcoming Senate investigation of this, which apparently there's going to have to be some sort of Senate investigation, the White House is working furiously to see that it's conducted by Pat Roberts, the wholly owned subsidiary of the Bush White House, who is the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, rather than being conducted by Arlen Specter, the, you know, dangerously not as completely compliant Republican senator who sits atop the Judiciary Committee. But in any event, there will be some sort of hearing, and we may indeed find out more details, as with the Intelligence Committee's investigation of weapons of mass destruction intelligence. We may need to read between the lines in order to come up with the real story, but in any event, there will be more facts being kicked around, I'm sure, in the months ahead. But knowing what we know now, there is still this lingering question. Well, I mean, I'll get to the lingering question in a minute, but I will try and wrap this up because I don't want to spend my 45 minutes of podcast time just talking about this, which is what happened on Friday. I keep talking about the asterisk that I'm accepting Bush's argument that as Commander-in-Chief, he has a constitutional responsibility for defending the country. And that's true. In that Meet the Press appearance, Condoleezza Rice quoted, as the President has done on several occasions, quoted his oath of office. You know, she mentioned this President swore an oath to preserve and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that was gratifying on some level because Condoleezza Rice actually quoted it correctly. You know, when Bush quotes that, he immediately moves into the sort of awkward misapplication of it, that this means he's sworn an oath to preserve and defend the people of the United States. You know, he doesn't really distinguish between preserving and defending the Constitution and preserving and defending the actual citizens of the country. And, you know, given that every anti-democratic, tyrannical dictator in history has justified his power on the basis of protecting the people against some sort of threat, this argument, to me, is a little bit scary. You know, maybe not as scary as the prospect of Al-Qaeda, you know, detonating dirty bombs in major cities, scary, but still pretty darn scary. The way Condoleezza Rice expressed it in that Meet the Press appearance, I don't have the direct quote, but to my mind, it at least showed a little more of an understanding that there was a pirouette being performed there. The language was just a little more. There was an extra phrase or two to kind of bridge between the one concept and the other that, to my suspicious mind at least, led me to think that Condoleezza Rice is more aware than Bush is. In Bush's case, you know, I really get the impression that he doesn't see any inconsistency there. He doesn't see an inconsistency between swearing an oath to preserve and defend the Constitution and being willing to set aside key provisions of that Constitution to undercut them and you know, basically tear them up and throw them away in the name of preserving and defending the people of the United States in his constitutional authority as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. So, anyway, I felt like Condoleezza Rice gave at least a little bit of lip service while basically making the same argument. But let me get to this asterisk. So I'm basically saying that, yeah, I will acknowledge that on some level Bush is certainly responsible for defending the people of the United States against terrorist attacks. And I will acknowledge that in the wake of 9/11, the analysis one makes of that question in deciding whether a given presidential action is justified or not justified does change somewhat. But for me, it changes this way. So here's my footnote, my asterisk on this grudging acceptance that Bush has a point with his argument. The point is this, that Al-Qaeda is not a new phenomenon. It's not new to Bush. Al-Qaeda existed prior to Bush, and terrorism existed prior to Bush. The rise of suicide attacks, suicide bombings and whatnot, at least to my understanding of it, it became a lot more common during the years of the Clinton presidency. So that's not something that if you go back to the Munich Olympics and the terrorist attacks there, you didn't have people strapping bombs on themselves and walking into crowded places and blowing up as many people as they could. That particular form of insanity and evil is something that we've come up with lately in our ongoing march of human progress. But the point that, Bush's argument is basically that, we can't have these quaint constitutional protections against warrantless searches and seizures in an era of Al-Qaeda, because we are at war, he says. And of course, since the war metaphor has been defined in a way that basically admits no end to this war, what he's basically saying is we can no longer afford, forever, for the rest of the history of the United States, in whatever form the U.S. continues to exist, we can no longer afford the Fourth Amendment. We can no longer afford those sorts of limitations on government power, that the world is too dangerous today, the government must be allowed to, individual citizens, persons, and dwellings are no longer, and conversations are no longer to be considered safe against government searches, government law enforcement interception, even in the absence of probable cause, even in the absence of a court-supplied warrant. And to me, that is only true to the extent that we're talking about a U.S. government headed up by George W. Bush. Though Clinton faced Al-Qaeda, previous presidents faced the scourge of international terrorism, transnational terrorism, without the need to so thoroughly throw away those values that are fundamental to this country, without the need to publicly acknowledge, in effect, at least through their actions, if not through their words, that the U.S. was going to consider torture to be an instrument of state policy, that the U.S. was going to allow warrantless searches and phone tapping of people inside the United States, people who were not suspected of being connected with terrorism. And I guess that's the last point I'll make about this, is that one of the things Bush has said, or attempted to maintain, is that, all of these searches involved people who were known, or phone numbers that were known to be associated with Al-Qaeda, that these were not just, fishing expeditions, these were narrowly targeted eavesdropping operations. And I'm not so sure I believe that. I think that if the connection with terror was as strong as he is claiming, I don't see why the FISA courts would have been an inadequate way of going about this. I don't think they had to run, the Bush team had to run the political and legal risk of conducting these warrantless conducting this warrantless eavesdropping if they didn't have some compelling reason. And the reason I think is that the reason I would assume, and hopefully we'll learn more about this, but at this point I think the reason is likely to turn out to be that it was that the types of eavesdropping they were doing is a type that would not have been allowed under FISA, that the FISA courts would have said no to it. And if you look at the history of the FISA courts always saying yes, what that says to me is that basically these were situations in which the Bush team could not show any sort of probable cause. And knowing what I've learned about the way the NSA operates and the kinds of technologies they use overseas, what that says to me is that these were not narrowly targeted in any sense. These were wholesale data mining operations. These were things like, every phone conversation that goes through this, that comes in or out of the United States, we're going to monitor that for, or any, that involves any phone, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt, and say any phone conversation that involves a an overseas conversant, that we're going to extract any of those that match certain patterns that, you know, include the words terror or include the words, I don't know, you know, bomb or hijack or Al-Qaeda or Allah or, you know, long list of phrases that in and of themselves could be completely innocuous. And this is where it gets scary, of course, because now what you're talking about is citizens of the United States, law-abiding citizens, who merely happen to be using certain words, having their conversations listened to by the Bush White House. And that's a great power that our Constitution specifically denies to the president. And it's not just some quaint 18th century notion, to my mind at least, that led the framers of the Constitution to deny, the framers of the Bill of Rights, to deny that right to the executive branch, to the federal government. These people were, you know, they were familiar with threats. The nation, the threat faced by the United States in 1790 was far graver, I think, to any, at the time, any rational assessment than the threat we faced on, you know, December 12, 2001. You know, they had every reason to believe that their country was not actually going to survive. They were weak, and other foreign powers were strong. They were facing, grave threats. And yet they put in their constitution that the federal government did not have the power to conduct warrantless searches. Bush has set that aside, and, you know, to the extent that it's justified, I think it's justified because he's president, because he's demonstrated in a way that Bill Clinton never did, or any previous president did, that he is not capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time. He cannot both uphold the Constitution that he has sworn to uphold and protect the country. So we have a choice, and this is what I talked about in my my simple choice item on lies from a few weeks ago. You know, we can have the United States as we've grown up with it. We can have a country that values the individual above the state, that has constitutional protections against things like unreasonable searches. Or we can have George Bush as president. We just don't get to have both at the same time. And given that Bush is the president right now, I think he may be justified in authorizing the NSA to conduct these kinds of operations inside the U.S., because clearly he's incompetent to such a degree that he cannot protect the country without those sorts of tools. But for myself, I would much rather have my country and not have George Bush as president. Now, of course, for me, that's not any great sacrifice. I've never wanted George Bush as president, but that's the way I see this now. And again, this topic is threatening to cause me to filibuster my own podcast, so I'm going to stop talking about it and move on. It'll be a lighter topic to discuss. Movies. I've seen a few movies lately. Wanted to mention that. I watched Love Actually on DVD again last night. Fabulous movie that gets better every time I watch it. I think Richard Curtis and the cast really delivered there. Parts of it that didn't appeal to me so much the first time I watched it have grown on me in subsequent viewings, and I think, of course, that's a sign of a great movie. When I first watched the film, the storyline about Colin Frissell, the loveless sandwich vendor who goes to the United States because there he would be a sex god, that storyline, you know, was my least favorite when I first saw the film, but it's definitely grown on me. I think it's pretty funny now, and provides a really nice balance to some of the other things going on in the film. But I won't talk about that. I've talked about that movie before. Go to lies.com and read my review to find out what else I like about the movie. In the theaters, I've seen King Kong, and I've seen The Chronicles of Narnia. And I have to say that despite my Peter Jackson fanboy leanings, the legacy of his Lord of the Rings is deft and loving handling of The Lord of the Rings, a book that I was fully prepared to have screwed up big time by a big-budget movie adaptation. In spite of all that, I have to say that I think that Narnia wins out over King Kong in terms of, my personal thumb position meter. I would give, King Kong a qualified thumbs up, but Narnia, I think, is really an excellent movie in a way that King Kong isn't. In the background, you will hear the sound of the railroad crossing where I'm now waiting. A little unanticipated sound effects. In Narnia, I just think it was very effectively handled. The adaptation was really good. And as a movie, I think it worked really well. I guess I don't really have much else to say about it, so I won't. The comment I made about King Kong in giving a review in Ishar after going to see it was that, yeah, it was 3 hours and 20 minutes long. Given that during nearly half of that time you did not have Naomi Watts' face 40 feet wide across the screen, that probably was a little long. But really, the shots of Naomi Watts, Peter Jackson loves to do those tight close-ups, and certainly it was effective in her case. And for all the things that I think he's kind of revealed as weaknesses as a filmmaker, I think, he clearly gets that part right. But it definitely felt like the movie as a whole felt like a director's cut. And I think it could have been a better film, a significantly better film, if it had been a good deal shorter. This podcast would probably be a better podcast if it were a good deal shorter. Here I am kind of thinking about what else to talk about. It's really a risk I run, I think, is that, when I was working at home and weblogging a lot, or at least weblogging a lot more, I had more to say. I was reading things, I was thinking about things that were in the news, and in writing about them, I would develop those thoughts and come up with new thoughts about them. These days I'm listening to a lot of audio. I'm listening to a lot of other podcasts, and I'm listening to audio of PBS programs and NPR. But I'm not really doing the other part of that. I'm not really, that's a reaction. That's not so much an active engagement with that material. I think it leaves me with relatively little to say. I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast the way the story about Bush's warrantless searches had engendered a moment of clarity, that had this moment of realization that, given what I've talked about, that given that he's incompetent as president, he probably does need to set aside the Constitution if he's going to be able to protect the country. And those moments of clarity are interesting. They, in some ways, it's an emotional response. You've got all these little bits and pieces, and you're trying to figure out what the world means. And then suddenly you just see and recognize some aspect of it in a way that's really non-conscious or pre-conscious. Now, I think it really goes back to being a hunter-gatherer on the plains of Africa and seeing the face of a predator, suddenly emerge from the line of grass that you're scanning nervously, and it triggering all these reactions in your body and your mind and your biochemistry that, again, really are a non-rational process. It's just a quick emotional response. And, we see patterns like that in data that's sometimes random, but we also do recognize truths. We see things that we do need to see and understand that our preconceptions have previously prevented us from seeing. And this is, both the way in which people see things that sort of confirm their suspicions in a positive way, and also in terms of recognizing things that confirm our fears. I think for me, one of the strongest moments like that I've had in my life well, I can think of a bunch of them, but one of the strongest I've had in the last several years was when, I guess now it would be 5 years ago, when Julia, my daughter, was in the hospital for her her heart operation. She was, I won't go into all the detail, I'm going to wrap this up quickly here, but when Julia was 9, she was diagnosed with what turns out to have been a congenital defect of her aorta, something that had caused her to have an audible heart murmur the whole time she was growing up, and we had a number of pediatricians look at it, and in fact, at one point, it even visited Children's Hospital of L.A. to have a specialist take a look. And in all those visits, it was never diagnosed that actually what she had was a condition called coarctation of the aorta, where the aorta is constricted, basically, and this manifests as diminished blood flow to the lower half of the body and heightened blood pressure in the upper half of the body as the heart works harder to try and overcome this blockage. And left untreated, it would likely have led to her death, if not by now, then certainly relatively soon. But when it was diagnosed when she was 9, thanks to the suggestion of her wonderful pediatrician, Dr. Saida Hamdani, and the apt diagnosis by her cardiologist, Dr. Bilal Haraki, and then subsequently the surgery performed by the great heart surgeon, Dr. Hillel Locks, given the shout-outs to the three physicians who I think share credit for Julia's being alive today. In any event, she went into the hospital and had this procedure where they remove the constricted part of her aorta and sew the two pieces back together again. And, you know, anytime you go in and have, in essence, open heart surgery, it's a serious thing. And in her case, what made it dramatically worse was that she had a post-operative complication where she, it's still not clear exactly what the cause of all of it was, but she had an allergic reaction to an anti-nausea drug, one of the multitude of drugs she was on in the wake of that operation, a drug called droperidol, which caused her to have sort of this slow motion, you know, this tonic-clonic response where her body was stiffening over the course of a day. And until Nurse Carol, someone else who should be mentioned in the list of people who were responsible for saving Julia's life, Nurse Carol figured out what was going on, you know, talked to the doctors and got her administered Benadryl, which corrected the droperidol reaction, but which in turn sort of unmasked this ongoing issue that caused her to seize. So she had a seizure, and that led to internal bleeding, which led to the need to give her a transfusion, and for a while there was thought that she would need to be opened up again to correct whatever the problem was. They didn't know if the bleeding was from the site of the surgical repair or if it was something else. To wrap this up, the thing that led to myself, the moment of clarity I talked about, I guess the point I'm making about this moment of clarity thing is that it isn't always true. You know, you see the tiger in the bushes or the lion in the line of grass, but it's not always really there. And who knows, you know, maybe in the case of my deciding that Bush clearly is unqualified to be president and therefore we need to have a suspension of civil liberties at least until we can get him out of office, I may not be correct about that. You know, just because I feel it viscerally and emotionally and it seems to satisfy a lot of different pieces of data doesn't prove that it's true. And in the same sense, the moment of clarity I had with Julia's 10 days in the ICU, the moment of clarity I'm thinking of here is not necessarily, turns out not to have been correct, for which I'm grateful in this case. What I'm talking about is how for both Linda, my wife, and myself, there was a really grim moment during Julia's hospitalization where each of us separately ended up believing that she was going to die, or in Linda's case, had already died. In my case, it was the moment of her seizure. You know, we'd had this, we were splitting up the duties at staying with Julia in the ICU. So typically I would be there in the night and Linda would be there during the day, or one of us would be there for going on 24 hours and then the other would come and spell the person. And we were getting really frazzled. You know, this was supposed to be 2 or 3 days in the ICU and then on into the hospital room for a few more days of recovery. And as I say, it turned into, you know, close to 10 days in the ICU. But in my case, we had this issue with the droperidol interaction, and I hadn't slept much, and we, you know, had this very dramatic situation. It was like a house episode. They'd figured out that she was having this reaction to the droperidol. They administered the Benadryl, and within, you know, 15, 20 minutes, you could see Julia start to come back. You know, she had been going into this state. It's hard for me to even remember it, but to see her come back from that was really emotional. And even, you know, Nurse Carol, the hardened ICU nurse, was weeping at, you know, just a very dramatic moment. And then at that moment, you know, in the midst of that, suddenly as I was standing there by the bed with Nurse Carol there in the room, Julia seized, you know, and it was this very dramatic, very scary action, and the alarms are going off, and people are, you know, the doctors and nurses are rushing into her room, and one of them at one point, you know, tells me, kind of, you know, puts a hand on my arm and says, look, it's going to get pretty crowded in here, and kind of motioned me, you know, back away from her bedside. And I watched these people come in and work on her, and I thought at that moment, I had this moment of clarity I've talked about, that, oh, my gosh, she's going to die. I'm about to watch my daughter die, which turned out not to be the case. So the moment of clarity in that case was not all it was cracked up to be, but it certainly had an effect on me, and it's a moment that I'm sure I'll never forget. Linda's similar moment the following morning, after I'd been there all that day and then all that ensuing night, as the internal bleeding was going on, what we subsequently figured out was internal bleeding, probably a result of the seizure, but we don't know for sure. But her blood pressure, her heart rate kept increasing. And, you know, at nighttime in an ICU, you sort of have the second team on hand. Typically, you have the nurses and who are not as adept, and, you know, taking nothing away from the nurses there that night, there was a sense I had that, you know, this situation was clearly wrong. There was something wrong with her and getting worse. Her heart rate kept going up, and the nurse kept adjusting where the little monitor would start to sound its audible alarm, kept adjusting that upward after talking with the doctors. And, you know, again, I was frazzled and exhausted. And it wasn't until the next morning that the doctors got in and they finally figured out what was going on. And they decided she needed a transfusion. And, you know, this was not a good sign. And I got on the phone to Linda that morning around 6 or 7 o'clock and was just at the end of my tether. You know, I just really felt I needed a break. So I called her and I was trying to explain to her all that had gone on and where we were at with the doctors. And at one point, as I was trying to describe it to her, I was overwhelmed with emotion, and I'm trying, you know, I'm stopping for a second to kind of collect myself and not, you know, start sobbing into the phone. And Linda decided that what she was hearing from me was, she believed that I was calling her to ask her to come in, and telling her it was because I was tired, and telling her it was because there was this ongoing issue with Julie and she needed a transfusion and somebody needed to be there, and I just didn't feel like I was, you know, I had any reserves left, I needed to get a break. She formed the conclusion from that actually what had happened is that Julia had died, but I didn't want to tell her by phone. I wanted her there in person. So she had this horrifying trip to the hospital, you know, the half hour or so from where we were staying at her brother Dick's house, believing that Julia had died. And it wasn't until she got there that she found out, oh no, you know, what I told her was actually literally the truth. I was just very tired and Julia was, you know, having this problem, and, you know, I wanted someone there and needed to get some rest. So we each had our moment of believing Julia either was going to or had died, and that was really grim. And it definitely led to this, you know, this moment of clarity when we, towards the end of when things, she started to come back from all these problems and started to get better, and we had this moment of talking to each other and just sharing the same realization that, you know, this really did change everything. Like Bush with his 9/11 sighting, things were going to be different in the future. And, you know, we promised ourselves and promised each other that, you know, from now on, we're done being harsh, demanding parents. We're done pushing her to do better in school, to, you know, be more responsible, all the things that as parents you want your kid to do and be. From now on, it was, you know, her happiness above all. She'd paid her dues, and whatever we as parents could do to make her happy, that was our mission from that point forward in life. And, you know, that was certainly a valid sentiment, and one that, with greater or lesser success, we've clung to since then. Although, you know, it didn't take long to get back to, Julia, clean your room. Damn it, what's wrong? Why can't you be more responsible? So it's part of living, I guess, part of going through life and what it teaches you. That's it for this podcast, though. I've run out of things to say. I probably run out of battery life, or will within the next few minutes. This copyrighted podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I'm John Callender, and thank you for listening.